Coming up in this week, computer hardware, Raspberry Pi 3, Samsung S7, Huawei's MateBook, new AMD CPUs, and the DX12 problem. That's all on Microsoft. All that and more, it's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
Hi, everybody. It's time for our annual audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It helps us understand our audience better, know what you like and don't like, how you listen to the show. It also helps us tell advertisers what kind of people listen. But I promise you, your feedback is always kept personally anonymous. All you have to do is visit twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. It'll just take a few minutes, and it'll help us make Twit even better. We really appreciate your support and any help you can give us. twit.tv/survey.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 353, recorded March 3rd, 2016. Pi 3, S7, and a little DX12 problem. Welcome to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch Weekly Show that aims to bring you the most useful, most informative, most engaging, and apparently, according to this opening, most consonant-free content on the Twit Network. We're here to talk about hardware. We're doing some $35 PC action. There may be a guest appearance by the Galaxy S7 fresh from the city of Barcelona, Spain. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, the huff you just heard came directly from the mouth of my partner in crime, Mr. Ryan Shrout. Welcome back from your international travels.
Thank you. It was a good show. It was actually, it was very different than anything I had ever been to before, actually. Mobile World Congress being, you know, obviously focused on mobile devices. But it's not nearly as big as CES. The convention centers, sure, they're like, there's 8 halls, but they're a little bit smaller. And the pathway up to all of them is like actually above all the convention centers. So like, mm-hmm, you go up an escalator and then there's like this dedicated pathway that just goes between all the halls on an upper level. And you go down any given escalator to get into that particular hall. It works really well. And you don't have to like bounce between hotels and convention centers and hotels and back and forth and back and forth. It's pretty much like it's all in one spot, which is a nice change.
Well, you know, is it a more genteel convention? Is the food better or are the crowds less insane, or is it just as elbow to elbow thrashing?
Food was definitely better. The crowds I agree. They give you more space between booths as well. Like if you were hovering around the Samsung booth, if you were hovering around the Huawei booth, those were crowded. You would have to, uh-huh, wait or push your way in front of somebody to get, you know, hands on with the device, which I had to do every once in a while. Nothing like, you know, going to an LG booth at CES or Samsung booth at CES, right? Like it's a much better control. I mean, and it's, you know, it's kind
people of... starving people fight less aggressively for food than some people will fight to get into an LG or Samsung booth at CES.
Right.
I have been elbowed in the ribs. I have been shoved. I have been kicked. That was interesting. When I was in the middle of a shoot, somebody kicked me. I guess I thought I would ignore them because I turned around, sorry, and asked them if they'd like to kick me. No, it was great. It was great. They like.
No, I meant it was me. I apologize.
No, it was not you. Because I would bring it up every time we did a podcast ever if it had been you. But let's talk about, you know, we kind of covered the big stuff last week, right? The Samsung S7, S7 Edge, LG G5, the friends, the modules look fantastic. You've just literally gotten your hands on an S7. What do you think of it so far?
I really like it. In my 10 minutes I spent with it in Barcelona and the 10 minutes I spent with it here, I am a fan of the curved screen design. Mm-hmm. We were having a debate internally here just now, like, does it make it harder to hold? Kind of it, right, does, but it's still a big phone. It's bigger than the iPhone 6S, right? So it's not going to be a really good side-by-side comparison, but this is an iPhone 6S. It's been turned on the screen, so you actually see something on there, maybe. Or maybe not. Okay. My iPhone is off for some reason. Awesome. But it's a bigger phone. So if you want the Galaxy S7 standard is basically the exact same size as the iPhone 6S. And this is somewhere between the 6S and the 6S Plus. But it's all glossy. It's all glass. The curved edges make the screen look really impressive. But it does mean that, you know, your kind of grip on the device is maybe a little bit lowered because of it. So far, the only other thing I've really looked at is camera performance, and it's pretty impressive. Really fast shutter, really, really fast focus capability. It's really good. So far, it's really good. I haven't tested anything really dark, but it's like I'm holding it up now, right? And I'm looking towards the back of the office where it's kind of dark, and then there's studio lights that are in the frame as well. And it's doing a very good job of HDRing it, if you will, to capture as much of it as it can through. So a lot of interesting modes.
I was listening to somebody it's a lower megapixel. I'm like, they did that to get bigger pixels, I bet, for better low light performance, because it's like a F1.2, something ridiculous like that. Very sensitive sensor for a camera.
It does have a dedicated food mode for the camera, so I think that's maybe the most important part. I don't know exactly what that does for a camera.
Ladies and gentlemen, go to www.ryanslunch.com to find the latest high-resolution photos of Ryan's Lunch available to you daily at ryanslunch.com.
That's true.
it's interesting, right? It seems like they brought the micro SD card back. They acknowledged people need local storage. They made a really concerted effort to do a better camera. I thought it was interesting with the G5, LG stepped away from sort of the quad HD camera and focused on more battery life. The modules, I think, and removable batteries are a fantastic idea. Was there anything, Intel started circulating the idea that they learned a lot from WiMAX, and this time they're going to be right in the thick of 5G LTE, but this time they're going to talk to other people and be involved in the industry, and they announced partnerships with Verizon and a whole bunch of other folks. Were there any surprises, anything you didn't expect to see that showed up? Outside of Intel being like, the Internet of Things is going to be all about low-power devices that include 5G LTE, so we're going to get in on... that was a little surprising for me.
Yeah, the whole 5G thing was almost disingenuous for everybody, because that's like a 2020 product, right? Like, that's not something people are going to see.
2018. They say... No, I have it on decent authority. AT&T and Verizon are already sampling 5G technologies, right? Because 5G is effectively a marketing term at this point, just like 4G was. But I understand initial layouts, we have 5G in 7 urban areas in North America kind of moment. That's going to come in 2018. Or do you think that's too aggressive? You obviously think that's too aggressive.
I think it's too aggressive. The things I have talked about, like when I talk with Qualcomm or Intel, they're saying a realistic deployment in the U.S. is probably 2020. But maybe 2018 point to like first device, consumer level testing versus 2020 being kind of more of a wide release of 5G. I don't really know. I don't think anything else really stood out to me as like super surprising. There's one thing I've got in the list here that if we want to jump to, we can. If we want to wait to it, the Huawei MateBook.
That was interesting. I can't decide if that is completely... Well, did you get hands-on with it?
I did. It's a very interesting device. So it's a 2-in-1. It's a tablet. I think it's a 10-inch tablet. No, it's a 12-inch tablet, I think. And it really... it's based on an Intel processor. It's an Intel Core M series processor. They'll have variants of Core M3, M5, M7. You have like a portfolio, a folio option with it, right? That has like a fold-out keyboard and a kickstand type thing. Very similar to, it's kind of like a combination of what an iPad smart cover is and then a Surface Pro 4 type cover is. But you can see from this, it's a very, very slim device. But it also has a lot of performance in there, right? It's not an ARM powered device. It's a Core M. It's Skylake based. And it can get all the way up to Core M7 part in there. It starts at $699, with a Core M3, 128 gigs of storage and 4 gigs of memory, which is actually pretty good, I think. It's very, you know, I don't want to say it's simplistic in design because there's not a whole lot to it, right? It's very thin. Right. You've got rounded edges. It's like, imagine an iPad Pro, but with Windows and, you know, an Intel processor inside. And you get an idea of what the form factor is. They have an active stylus for it. They have it's got a USB Type-C connection for both data and power. There's an optional add-on for like an external block that offers battery, Ethernet, HDMI output, 2 more USB ports. So you get a lot of, like, it's a full PC out of this machine. It's starting at $699. It's Huawei's first PC that they've ever built. So that's kind of interesting in and of itself. And Intel was kind of they were like the first person to me that told me, oh, you need to go see this thing. Like, this is what we envisioned 2-in-1s looking like when we built the Core M processor, right? This was the form factor. This was the design style. You know, you get the impression that Intel spent a lot of time working with Huawei to make sure that, like, performance would be met and qualification was done and all that type of stuff. Right. As Intel tends to do, they'll kind of pick one product for each kind of generation or subset and say, okay, this is the one we're going to like put all of our time on to showcase. This is how our platforms can work if done correctly. And the Huawei MateBook is that. It's supposed to be out in a couple of months, maybe less than that, maybe this month. They wouldn't specify for sure. But I was pretty impressed by that. That was the one thing that I didn't know I was going to see out there or didn't expect to really see out there.
Their new $200 phone is the build quality on that is really nice too. The Honor 5X.
So the GX8?
No, the 5X.
The 5X.
Shannon just for, you know, because it really, I can't wait to see what you know, Motorola/Lenovo does with the Moto G now, because it's, I don't think it's sort of like, you know, fall down a flight of stairs into a bucket of water proof as the Moto G is, but it is a fantastic looking screen and feature set for $200, and it is unlocked. It'll be interesting. I mean, I'm kind of curious to see where that goes. The laptop, I thought, was really, really interesting for them. I did not see pricing information on that. Or
the
no.
MateBook?
No, it was $700 to $1,600. Sorry, yes. I was looking at something else.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, it can get expensive, right? $1,600, that's going to be your Core M7 with probably 512 gigs of storage and 8 or 16 gigs of RAM. For me, this is a more interesting part at $699, where you're going to have very competent performance, right? A Core M3 versus Core M7. The performance difference is not going to be night and day. So as long as you get enough storage, then I think you should be good off. So I have asked these guys for a review sample. Hopefully we'll be able to get one in and mess around with it and see what we actually think. But that's probably a late March to mid-April-ish product release.
Ish. Boy. I got the Raspberry Pi 3 in. I was kind of amazed. I didn't realize until it showed up that it was 4 years from the original Raspberry Pi release. Leap year. So in honor of the return of February 29th, they did the Raspberry Pi 3. And it's an interesting device, right? It's $35. I'm holding it right here. And hey, kids, it looks like a Raspberry Pi. And if you know, you look really, really closely and you have the right kind of eyes, you might notice that where some LEDs used to be right here is a little blocky antenna, and that's the Wi-Fi and Bluetooth antenna, because they finally incorporated Wi-Fi and Bluetooth on the board. They've got a fairly fast Broadcom chipset in there. It's 50% faster, give or take, than the Raspberry Pi 2. It is significantly faster than the Raspberry Pi 1. It's quad-core, which is a nice addition. There's only 1 gigabyte of RAM, which a bunch of people... it was interesting to watch the responses, because some people were like, yes, Wi-Fi is on board. Bluetooth is on board. Awesome. And then there were a lot of people who were like, I can't believe you haven't put a SATA adapter. I can't believe you haven't put more than 1 gigabyte of RAM on it. I can't believe... and this actually one is probably a pretty legitimate complaint, because essentially the USB and the Ethernet share a single USB input, for lack of a more appropriate term, on the processor. That's been a complaint. So if you want to sort of read and write things from a USB drive through the Ethernet port, you run into traffic issues. Not that you run into a lot of traffic issues with a processor of this size, but it was funny because Element 14 did a bunch of benchmarks of the of it, and then they did some benchmarks. They looked around to look at the sort of raw, like, you know, Whetstone type stuff, and performance wise it is in the neighborhood of a K7 or a Pentium 3. So the $35 PC is now up to $99,000-$2,000 desktop PC performance,
right,
with I suppose, if you think about it, slightly less RAM. But on the flip side, when you look at these, whether you're talking about this or, you know, I've got a chip PC over here, you know, as little standalone devices, as centers for appliances, as little tiny Linux servers, they're getting fairly powerful, which is pretty cool. I actually use this as a desktop to show off the web pages we were using on Tech Thing this week. And it was doing pretty well. Then it crashed. You know, it's got a version of Minecraft running on it. I actually had Minecraft and a browser running at the same time, which if you've ever tried to run the Raspberry Pi 2 as a desktop machine, you understand why I was kind of fascinated by that. But 8 million Raspberry Pis are out in the wild now, and it has a huge collection of projects and ideas. But it looks like a good part. Doesn't solve if you were frustrated with the sort of USB Ethernet combination. It doesn't solve that. It doesn't add SATA. It doesn't add USB 3.0. It doesn't add gigabit Ethernet, but it is considerably faster than the Raspberry Pi 2. And again, it's got Wi-Fi.
Would be good.
Mai Tai on board. Wi-Fi and Bluetooth 4.1 and low energy on board. So it's good stuff. Oh, and the GPIO pins are still exactly the same, and it uses, you know, all of the applications or all of the distros that have been made for the Raspberry Pi, you know, Model 2, Model 1 will work with this, which is, I think, very, very smart on their part. And it is a 64-bit part, but they are still running a 32-bit operating system, and the Raspberry Pi organization says they will be experimenting and testing to see if they get any advantage out of a 64-bit version of the operating system. So,
okay.
There we have it. I get excited.
I really don't have a whole lot of experience with that platform, but I enjoy watching your coverage of it, and I keep waiting for like the
thing that makes you want to do something with them.
Right, exactly. The one thing that's like, oh, I can do that with that, and move on and get into that type of thing. Not that I have a whole lot of extra time to focus on new projects, but I find it pretty interesting.
Just discovered 3D printing in a very intense way.
Yeah, if I turn the microphone around, you could probably hear the 3D printer running in the back of the office currently, trying to print accessories for GoPros. So,
oh my goodness. Thermaltake Core X9 E8DX Cube chassis review. I can't decide if this looks like a lot of other chassis we've seen or if it has its own distinct style to it. Is that a cruel thing to say?
No, it's not. It's not the first to go after this design style, for sure.
It's huge. You may think it's another mini ATX case, but this is an ATX, the EATX Cube chassis. How many drive slots does this have in it?
I don't know, but if you go back to that first picture again, and those three bays in the middle there, those are 5 1/4-inch bays.
Oh, wow.
Those are not 3.5-inch floppy drives. Those are optical drives, if you want them.
So this is 2 CD-ROM /DVD /Blu-ray drives plus in width.
Correct. If you look at down at the little bit next image down, where there's like the exploded view of a typical configuration, right? You can take a look at that GTX 980 Ti graphics card. There's two of them in there, and then like in relation to the rest of the case. And then if you scroll down the next two pictures where it kind of looks at like exploded diagrams, that's how many water blocks you could possibly fit in there. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. That's, radiators.
I was looking at that because you're talking about 420, 480, like huge, massive radiators that even I look at, you know, me who is attached a car radiator to a PC, look at and go, that's kind of big. But you've got room for 480 millimeters. One, if I'm reading this correct, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 plus like a 140 millimeter square one on the back. That's a lot. Front, top, rear, bottom, and left and right side. That's a lot of radiators. Two on the top, two on the bottom, one on each side. So, yeah, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 plus one on the back.
Yeah.
And, that's nuts. And when I say nuts, I mean awesome.
Yes, right. And this image here shows you, like, you can actually be crazy enough to stack them. If you really need more space and more water cooling capability, than what you have here. This particular story that Moy wrote, it's not the full review yet. It's basically just kind of looking through the features and tearing down the whole chassis. Because there are so many different options and configuration capabilities in this that, he decided to break this up into a two-parter. Story. So the next one will actually look at what actual performance you get out of it and how much water cooling stuff that he has. I say he has rather than how much you can put in there, because he doesn't have as much as you can. Yes, than he could put in there, right? So it's got some interesting things, like the door panels are swappable if you want to change which side has the window and which side has the vents. The part where it has the power button and USB connections and front panel headers, you can switch that to the left or right side of the chassis, depending on what, you know, your configuration is, how your placement of the case is. Right. So there's some capabilities there. It can support two power supplies if you have that much stuff that you want to do that. But, I mean, clearly this is a case not for mere mortals. Or, like I asked the question last night, is like, can we put a mini ITX motherboard in here? Could you put one mini ITX motherboard and then just, you know, maybe you just like lots of fans and then, you know, you can do that too, right?
So. Well, and, you know, given the prices we've seen on some of the cases lately, it's pretty reasonable. $141 on Amazon,
yeah.
$160 yeah. bucks on Newegg, or I should say $158 on Newegg. Wow. I can't wait to see part two of that.
Yeah.
You know, I think might be able to get a small four-cylinder radiator inside of there. If
you might
if you're listening, Maury. Excuse me. Oh, man. Microsoft plans for PC and Xbox merging. Actually, you know, we should probably start with the DX12 benchmark stuff, which... And one of the most shocking things I think I've ever read on Twitter that didn't involve full frontal nudity... He pointed out yesterday that there were a lot of thoughtful, compelling, insightful comments being made on this story. Rather than
being facetious when I said that.
No. That's yeah. I brazenly assumed you were not being facetious. You know, Ashes of the Singularity DX12 and the Microsoft Store. You know, if I read this title, I think, oh, okay, so you're only going to be able to use DX12 for games that are purchased through the Microsoft Store, right? This is how they're going to kill off Valve and Steam. But Microsoft's not that insane, right? Please tell me they're not that insane, please.
No, the story is way more complex than that would even allow it to be anyway. So let me see how I can explain this in a shorter time frame. So last week, an updated version of the Ashes of the Singularity game was released to the media. Ashes of Singularity is a real-time strategy game that is kind of like the poster child, the first DX12. It was the first Mantle kind of real game. Maybe not the first, but one of the first Mantle games out there. And now it's, you know, they have DX12 implemented. They're going to integrate Vulkan. They're kind of upfront on the battles of APIs, if you will. So they released a new version with the benchmark. And we saw some odd behavior in that with AMD graphics cards, we couldn't figure out how to actually disable VSync. We couldn't figure out how to get it out of a VSync like capped frame rate state, but we could with NVIDIA cards. NVIDIA cards did not have that issue. And so we started to dive into some of these discussions, trying to figure out why this is the case. And it led us down a totally different pathway to talked to a bunch of people about what DX12 is, what the Microsoft Store is. Have you ever heard the term UWP, Patrick? Have you heard about the Unified Windows Platform or Unified Windows Applications?
I think of these.
Okay, these are
the applications that are going to run from the Internet of Things to the most massive, amazing desktops, plus Windows phones, plus laptops, plus low cost. Basically, the idea that all of the things will run off of a single application.
Right. Now, imagine trying to apply that philosophy to PC games, right? That you want
this
to make.
This is wonderful. We'll finally have a.
Or Rise of the Tomb Raider, a universal Windows application that will let you run it on your tablet, that Huawei 2-in-1 we just talked about, your high-end gaming PC, and Xbox One, and all essentially off of the same code. It sounds like a wonderful idea, except that there's a lot of complication to it, and there's a lot of restrictions to it. One of the restrictions that Microsoft has placed is that all games have to stay into a borderless windowed mode, which is like fake full screen. And what that actually means is it has to go through the game frames, the rendered frames have to go through the Windows compositing engine. And Microsoft wants it to do that so it can do things like it has a game capture overlay. It has the ability to send notifications over your game while you're watching or playing or whatever. Some things like that, right? Useful features to be sure. But
if you're a large organization trying to force vendors to create games that will work on your obscure and not particularly if you want people to write games for Windows phones, a great way to do it is to make them write them for the Xbox One and the PC.
Right.
Force them to, if they want to, put games on the Xbox One and the PC. But there's, for all 12 or 15 people out in the audience with Windows phones who are cheering at this thought, you also have to remember that you're talking about games that effectively, the best PC games, in another year or two are going to be difficult to make run on an Xbox One or a PlayStation 4 for that matter, and still virtually impossible to make the same. I don't see how high-end gaming is going to work, on a Windows phone.
Yeah,
that
I
seems
agree.
Complicated.
I agree. I agree. It's an incredibly complicated thing, but what it has also done is for the PC gamers that have kept this industry alive, the enthusiasts, it puts a lot of specific restrictions. Going through that compositing engine means you can never fully disable VSync. It also means that today, SLI and Crossfire don't function the way that they should function. It also means that potentially variable refresh rate technology.
They don't function the way Microsoft wants them to function.
Correct. They want to push it back onto the game developer and say, you guys kind of have to integrate it on your side because of things like all of the apps that you download from the Windows App Store are sandboxed. They're encrypted, right? They're you can't go in there and you can't mod them. You can't edit INI files. You can't do any of that type of stuff. So the game driver has difficulty, or the graphics driver, I'm sorry, rather, has difficulty doing the things that it's used to doing to these games. So it has issues with doing SLI and Crossfire profiles. It has issues, NVIDIA's GeForce Experience software doesn't really work because it can't change game settings on games purchased through the Windows App Store. There's a whole lot of restrictions that go into a game being sold on the Windows App Store. Now, that's not really a big deal once you consider, Rise of the Tomb Raider was sold on the Windows App Store, but it was also sold on Steam. So the obvious decision and what we would promote is for people to buy the game on Steam. But there are exclusive games that Microsoft has that will come out only on the Windows App Store. The Gears of War kind of Ultimate Edition remake came out this week. That's one of them. Quantum Break, I think, is supposed to be out this month. That is a Microsoft published game. It will only be sold through the App Store. It puts a lot of restrictions on all those things we've talked about. It makes benchmarks and performance evaluation very difficult for us. So it makes my job extremely difficult. We can't use the same tools that we've used for years and years and years to measure performance and accurately and timely fashion provide people with data on how these games perform, what graphics cards perform how, and, you know, and that's how we get improvements in the industry, right? Is we are able to use these tools to point out errors to people. So it's a really complicated thing. And this, and it's, I broke all these stories up, the controversy around DirectX 12, the MS plans for PC and Xbox merging. It's all kind of the same story because of how it all unfolded, right? That Microsoft wants to, Microsoft often has these claims of, we really want to make PC gaming work this time for really.
PC gaming has been working for a long time.
Without their help. Right.
Yeah. Like, sometimes despite their help.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Windows games for Windows Live, a perfect example of a faltered Microsoft initiative that really actually only hurt the community, because the handful of games that came out with that integration basically broke when they shut down games for Windows Live, and people had, they had, developers had to kind of go back in and hack out the GFWL tech out of the games. So, but I applaud the idea of for a couple of things, right? That cross compatibility between games would be beneficial for PC gamers, because it would bring games that were exclusively on the console to the PC. That's what Quantum Break is, rather, right? And that's a benefit for PC gamers. Phil Spencer at Microsoft also said that they plan on iterating on Xbox hardware more frequently than they have in the past, not going these 7 to 8 year cycles. They wanted to do it more like your upgrade cadence of a cell phone. And if they do that, if you can get past the complications of multiple hardware platform or hardware configurations and compatibility and all that, that's something PC's been addressing for a long time. But the idea that the PC gamers won't be hindered by console ports that have to target very, very low end hardware. Now, if we have, you know, slightly higher end console hardware every couple of years, that would be a benefit for us as well. In theory, developers will be able to target higher end minimum specs for their games. So I think there's the potential for this to do good things, but the way it was implemented and discussed and shown to the world is not a good thing, right? It was done very half-baked, and Microsoft has to, based on their previous reputation, they have a lot of work to do to, like, kind of prove themselves worthy of even really addressing the PC market. It sounds crazy because everybody's the games plays Windows, uses Windows, but they're not a major player in the ecosystem of PC gaming yet.
Yet.
Yeah.
We wait with bated breath. This sounds like it's one of those initiatives that's going to irritate a lot of people and then collapse, but I might be an optimist. on a more cheerful note.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
No. We talked about it too long. You're right. We should move on. It's. I just don't know. You just never know.
It's either going to be great for PC gaming, or it's going to suck for PC gaming, or what I think is the most likely option, it's going to irritate a lot of developers, but not have much impact on end users of PC gaming. We'll find out. First FreeSync over HDMI monitors launch. Is this a big deal? Why is this a big deal? Have we all been dying for FreeSync over HDMI and just not knowing it?
You know, I don't really know the answer to that. because I asked the same question to AMD when they made this announcement. So there's an inherent benefit of FreeSync being available over HDMI. It means more monitors will be out there in the market that will support variable refresh, at least on AMD graphics cards, which is good for the industry as a whole. Variable refresh is a significant improvement for PC gaming, for PC users in general. Now, had FreeSync over HDMI been backwards portable to existing HDMI monitors, that would have been a fantastic thing. There are so many monitors out there that are HDMI, people that have HDMI-enabled configurations. That would have been great. But that's not how it works. It's new monitors that come out that have kind of a worked-around HDMI spec that will enable FreeSync capability over it is how you have to get it. So it's new monitors. And for me, so the argument was that a lot of monitors ship with HDMI but don't ship with DisplayPort. And I guess that's true. There are some that do that. And I mean, two of these Samsung monitors are exactly that. But it kind of doesn't make sense to me, because HDMI charges a royalty. DisplayPort does not. So to me, like, there's no reason if you have an HDMI port, you couldn't also have a DisplayPort input on any display that's released. Now, that being said, the Samsung displays are, they're all 1080p monitors. There's a 23.5-inch models and a, or I'm sorry, two 27-inch models and a 23.5-inch model. The two, the CF390, which is the lower end spec, has a 23.5 and a 27-inch variety. It only has an HDMI input and a VGA input, I guess, but does not have DisplayPort. So this will be able to support variable refresh over HDMI, and it's the first kind of announced retail available product for that. So that's good. It's a VA monitor, rated 4 millisecond response time, 250 nit maximum brightness, so that's kind of okay. And the larger version, the CF-591, actually has both an HDMI and DisplayPort, but it will support FreeSync over both of those connections. The Samsung website lists 60 hertz maximum refresh rates for these monitors, but I kind of get the hint from some other people that they actually go up to like 72 or 75, and that the variable refresh range would be like 48 to 75. If it only went up to 60... that's a 1080p 60 hertz variable refresh rate monitor is kind of like modestly useful to anybody, right? Because if you're running a 1080p, your frame rates under 60 frames per second should be very minimal, depending on what your hardware is, of course. And in while I support the idea of more and more monitors having this, which will drive prices down and maybe we'll push competition from NVIDIA and maybe make them support the adaptive sync capability in their driver in some capacity. The truth is like if you're a gamer and you're looking for a monitor, you don't want this monitor, right? So if you're looking for a gaming display, you don't want a 60 hertz monitor. You can get 120 hertz, 144 hertz TN panels relatively inexpensively. If you're willing to pay a little bit more, you can get IPS or VA-based models that have higher refresh rates than this. So I wouldn't call these gaming monitors by any means, but they would be interesting for – they're interesting in the academic sense of, hey, maybe now basically every monitor that comes out should have some kind of variable refresh capability. And this is kind of an indicative thing of that. And the only thing we're missing is the price, which would be really useful – because the whole idea of HDMI FreeSync is that it would be lower cost. It would be on lower cost monitors, I guess. So,
monitors
I don't know.
Costless.
Yeah.
It's an interesting idea. We should probably take a moment to discuss the excitement that is happening on PC Per this Sunday.
Hopefully.
You guys, for reasons I do not understand, you guys are going to do a 12-hour live stream starting at what time of day?
12 noon Eastern.
Oh, okay. I thought you were starting early. So you're going till midnight.
Yeah.
Wow.
Noon to midnight, 12 hours.
Awesome.
12-hour live stream, Patrick.
What are you going to do for 12 hours?
I don't know. I kind of know. If you look at the page, we kind of have a schedule. We have made a very detailed, very specific laid out schedule. That I am very confident that we'll be stuck to correctly throughout the entire day, starting at noon. You know, we're doing things like we're having interviews where Patrick is going to join us on the late part of it for an interview. We're going to have Dan Baker. Yeah, you. Yeah. He's a nice guy. You should look him up. Dan Baker, who actually works at Oxide Games, helped write the engine for Ashes of the Singularity. Ben Conchera from Polygon.com, Andrew Coonrad works at Logitech, Tom Peterson, David Hewlett. These guys are going to come on and do interviews. So that's a part of it. We're going to do some giveaways. We're going to do some QA sessions. We're going to do some gaming sessions. One gaming session, for example, is called the Steam Controller Challenge, where Ken believes that him playing Counter-Strike Go with a Steam controller will be able to beat me using a mouse and keyboard because he thinks I'm just that bad at the game. So he's going to lose horribly for that. You know, we're going to do – Alan's going to teach people how to solder. We've got like a 45-minute session where he's going to go like through a solder kit. And so here's how you do this and put together like a little hackathon-type gadget with that. So we're trying to make it interesting. We're trying to make it fun. The idea is to kind of go on there and show people the kind of stuff that we can do, promote our Patreon, say, hey, if you want to see more stuff like this, maybe not like a weekly 12-hour stream. That's a little extreme on our side.
Yeah, I was a little frightened there for a second.
Yeah, I think my wife might have something to say about that.
Goodbye.
Yes, exactly. but the idea is just to kind of have a lot of fun and see how many people we can wrangle into this whole deal, I guess.
Oh my goodness. Corsair headsets and mice and keyboard, EVGA power supplies, and a GTX 970, an AOC FreeSync 24-inch 1080p TN monitor from AMD, Logitech mice and keyboards, MSI motherboards, OCZ, Trion SSDs, and more prizes, ladies and gentlemen, will be available. So think about it this way. You should definitely tune in, because if you're the only one that tunes in, you'll get all the prizes.
True.
And the only way you're going to find out if you're the only person there is if you go, well, where? PCPer.com? Is it going to be hosted on PCPer?
Yep. If you go to PCPer.com/live, that's where it will be all day Sunday. And then we'll be streaming it to our Twitch channel, twitch.tv/PCPer, youtube.com/PCPer. And then if you go to PCPer.com now, you can find our little post on it called Streaming Out Loud. And you can see our little clip art style bullhorn bubble thing that we made to describe it. And it lists the guests and it lists the times and it lists the prizes and that type of stuff. So if you're interested, we'd love to have you come by and watch it. It may just crash and burn like an hour or two. We have no idea, right? We may
well,
just
let
cancel.
Me know if it crashes and burns, because I don't want to be sitting around with a headset on.
Understood. I will do that. Yeah. Yeah, we've got a second machine set up so that, like, if it all catches fire, we swap from the live feed to the static shot, and, like, you know, we'll be right back. Technical difficulties. Exactly.
So we'll have
some of that going for us.
That's his Sunday, people. Tune in. John Petty Research. They are the people who probably know more about the PC hardware, graphics, and video industry than anybody else on the planet. They just dropped a report about AIB sales. That would be add-in board sales, which to normal geeks like us means aftermarket GPU sales, or people who put GPUs in their own machines. It's still a minor percentage of all GPUs sold compared to pre-installed ones, but it's kind of crazy. AMD's market share climbed a little bit up to 21% from 18.8%. But what's crazy is that enthusiast add-in boards doubled in sales in 2015 over 2014. And sales have been flat, like 3 million units in 2011, 2012, 2013, 2014. And all of a sudden in 2015, you're selling 6 million add-in boards, GPUs. JPR says, quote, neither AMD nor NVIDIA released a killer new AIB in 2015, which, you know, in JPR terms means super high-end ones. Where, you know, this is a lot of GPUs. Now, you note, I'm sorry, actually, Scott notes in the article, Scott Michaud right. says, you know, GTX 970 and 980 launched super late in 2014. They could have directly impacted sales. But this is crazy. Does this mean, you know, people are moving up to higher resolutions and from 1080p? I mean, where is this coming from? This is a huge increase in sales.
I think what you're seeing is a change of, because you're seeing, like, they're selling fewer cards, but right. you're selling more higher end cards. You're seeing a mindset of what I think it is you still have fewer PCs being built, but the people that are building PCs are targeting a different experience for it, right? So, you know, think about it. Anything under, you know, $200 that was being sold, or under $150, you know, talking about the 750s, the below that, the, you know, the 210s, the 320s, the 420s that existed, all those cards that were basically like, you know, I have integrated graphics. What can I get slightly better than for as little money as possible? And instead, what you're seeing now is you know what? I want a PC for gaming, so I'm going to invest in the most important part for gaming PC, which is the graphics card, to a higher degree than I have in the past. You know, just me kind of listening to gaming podcasts and other journalists talk about stuff that don't deal with hardware all the time. I hear a lot of people talking about buying 980s and 980 Ti's, and that's a fairly expensive part, something that people are investing in because they're like, okay, there's a VR coming up. I see the value of PC gaming. I see the potential benefits of PC gaming and improved image quality over consoles already. And I think that's why you're seeing that change into the higher end. And also just consider that integrated graphics has improved so well, like on Intel's processors, that there's just not a need for lower end. So if you're going to buy something, you're going to buy $150, $250 part as opposed to what you might have bought, you know, in previous years. That's my theory that I'm going with.
It's a good theory. I like it. Yeah.
Thanks.
And now there is AMD refreshed the FM2 Plus line, APU and GPU. What do the prices look like? What do the performance look like? I assume they are still behind in overall performance, but this is still...
Yeah, these are modest improvements. No, it's not.
I mean, if you want a multi-core GPU or a multi-core CPU for gaming, and your number one consideration, you know, if you want more than two cores and you want to spend the least amount of money possible, that means going with AMD. You know, these are 95 watt parts, you know, 4 gigs of L2 cache, 16 lanes of PCI Express 3.0. They're all unlocked, which makes me think enthusiast part. What are we looking at performance-wise?
Modest increases, for sure, right? So, I mean, the A10 7890K, it's a quad-core part with now up to 4.3 gigahertz. I think we're talking about a 200 megahertz increase over the previous part. You get slight bumps in GPU frequency, but you're still maintaining 95-watt TDPs. These come with they're unlocked, meaning you can overclock them and there's no restriction on it. Now, as far as I know, as of this point, there's been no indication that there's some massive amount of headroom left in these processors that is untapped that would make them super competitive in any way that they aren't already, right? Also consider that they come with a new cooler. We've talked about that before from CES, the Wraith cooler, which is very quiet, high performance, looks a lot nicer than what we've seen in the past. And then the Athlon X4 is kind of it's a CPU, not an APU. And it actually does have 125-watt TDP, so it's a little bit more power hungry as well. You know, AMD is in a tough spot until Zen comes out, where they're trying to figure all this stuff out. And they're trying to make themselves continue to be relevant and useful in these, especially in kind of like the budget PC spaces. That's why the last slide on there talks about you can get a 1080p capable gaming APU with, you know, Intel component price of $215 for the A10 7890K and an AMD A88X motherboard, right? Obviously, there's other stuff that has to go into that system, but, you know, that's kind of a good starting point for it if you're on the extreme budget side of these systems. But nothing major happened here with these refreshes.
Well, it's nice to know that they're still updating the parts.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
That's a good thing. Western Digital, if we talked to about it not too long ago, Backblaze did their annual State of the Hard Drives report. They essentially use consumer hard drives and some, they use primarily consumer hard drives. They also use some enterprise grade hard drives. They use them in a giant data warehouse, or multiple data warehouses. There's a lot of drives. They go through a lot of drives. And as a result, they have a lot of information on drives dying, which is not necessarily a happy thing, but you know, it's, and it's interesting, but they give them an interesting perspective. These are probably being used in very different ways from the way you use your hard drive at home, but it's an indication of the longevity and the quality of the drive. And in terms of the least number of drives dying, no matter how you cut that particular pie up statistics wise, I'm pausing for a moment because, you know, somebody chose to send me a very snarky letter about how the HGST, which I still think of, you know, as a little company
right.
that bought Lenovo, you know, well, okay, not Lenovo, but IBM's drive unit. But technically speaking, you know, it's the UltraStars. Man, I just went right down the rat hole. in part because I, for some reason today, can't remember the name of the company before it became HGST, and now I want to call it Huawei, which is the mobile manufacturer. starts with an H. Used to own the hard drive company, but it's funny. So HGST is actually run discreetly and not run as a. My understanding is they're run as a completely owned subsidiary and not as a division of Western Digital. And I was suggesting that these drives from Western Digital were not the helium based drives were not actually the same thing as being Western Digital drives, even though yes, Western Digital does own Hyundai. You know, Western Digital did buy the drive company in question, HGST. In any case, that's the world's longest and worst introduction. What is actually an interesting rotating media hard drive story, which is that Western Digital is now using the helium technology or HelioSeal which is considered to be a big part of the reason why HGST's drives are so, you know, their longevity is so good. So, you know, pardon me for drawing that out into as long a discussion as possible. but it's, yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. 'Cause I didn't expect these to show up, at all on the consumer side. And we're looking at some pretty massive drives here, like 8 terabyte drives. HelioSeal technology. I think 10 terabyte drives. No, 8 terabyte drives maximum right now.
Yeah, on this line, 10 terabyte it existed on the enterprise version of this that was out prior. I mean, as you were saying, this marks kind of like the consumer introduction of this stuff. I do think it's kind of important to note, like, there's not going to be. Or Alan doesn't think that there's going to be any performance improvements on this. Right. Even though, like he's saying, there's less air friction, less heat production, and therefore, in theory, less power consumption, which is, again, not that important for consumers, but very important for Facebooks and Googles of the world that have to do all that storage. While capacitors are higher, we suspect performance won't be taking any large leaps with Western Digital's first-generation capacities. So, you know... This is capacity improvements, not performance improvements. As far as I know, they didn't say like what spindle speed these were running at. I know they've been getting more and more vague with spindle speed anyway, as hard drives continue to evolve.
I don't think
evolve.
Vague is the right word. I think fundamentally hiding spindle
okay.
speeds. I'd also point out HGST was formerly known as Hitachi Global Storage Technologies. And
there you go.
Was being run... In terms of the merger, was being run as a separate unit or a separate business unit or essentially a separate company from the rest of Western Digital. But
yeah,
I will acknowledge that HGST is fully owned or in the process of being fully owned and merged with Western Digital.
Yeah,
8 terabytes. Now I just want to start buying these and stuffing them into my NAS, which is already at 21 terabytes. This could more than
seems like enough
double. This would more than double the capacity of my Uber NAS.
Maybe you have a problem. Maybe you have a storage problem.
No, I don't have a storage problem because I have all the drives in my NAS. And that's, okay. ladies and all gentlemen, right. it's one way to roll. Oh, my goodness. more phone stories coming up on PC Per. What's coming up this week? Oh, well, actually, we probably should just take another moment to remind people to tune in on Sunday, all day Sunday, starting at noon Eastern, 3 o'clock Pacific. For the
yep.
glorious.
I double checked. You know your time slot now, right? It's what do I have?
I
yet?
Know my time
10,
slot when 10, I look
15
at my calendar.
PM my time. Well, I had one of the guests who tweeted out that they were going to have to get up early because they were going to be on at 9:15 a.m. And I was like, I had emails like, you know, we're not on at 9:15 a.m. my time. It's like, oh, that says PM. I was like, yep, okay, yep. Now we're on the same page. So he would have been 12 hours early. for his segment on the live stream. So that would have been problematic for sure. I don't know. We'll see how it goes. I have high hopes, but I also have realistic expectations for how technology works, how streaming works. So we'll go. We'll do this.
Oh my goodness. We did last week on Tech Thing. I did luxury or high end headphones, stylish, fantastic, feeling like you've wrapped the seat from a vintage Mercedes Benz around your head, except it sounds better. Headphones. This week I did cheap headphones, starting at $16. Did like five sets of headphones, all of them under $100. Three of them at $50 or under. Did the Raspberry Pi 3, which we had running live on the show, and Shannon went nuts. Again, said in a admirable and affectionate way, over a question about VPNs for mobile devices for Android and also, ironically, iOS. And she went hands-on with seven different VPN systems. And she gives you the quick summary for all of her experiences with those, which was a crazy chunk of things to review. So that's coming up on Tech Thing this week. With that, ladies and gentlemen, we should wrap this one up. We want to thank each and every one of you for listening to the show or watching the show, and to remind you to go to pcpur.com to find more of Mr. Shrout, or go to techthing.com to find more of Mr. Norton. That would be me. And if you want to find more Twitch, and we hope you do, go to twit.tv/twit or search for Twits on iTunes, your favorite podcatcher, and you should find a link and be subscribed. And hey, I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.